Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to start with Chapter 5 of The Feminization of American Culture. We finished Chapter 4 last time, so it makes sense to start with Chapter 5. I think you'd agree. This is called The Escape from History, or subtitle The Static Imagination, or that's the subtitle of the chapter. The Escape from History, The Static Imagination, the first subtitle is Teachers Without Texts. And last segment we heard about anti-institutionalism, a more personal, involved, almost charismatic approach to what might be called social problem solution if it were bureaucratized. Of course, you know where my sympathies lie. We heard about Dorothea Dix and other fellows who are less famous and how they went about spreading Christian doctrine. See what we have today. The Escape from History, The Static Imagination, Teachers Without Text, Chapter 5 of The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, a feminist. This is her PhD thesis, published as a book. She was born in 42, educated at Harvard, received her BA and PhD from 64 to 69. She studied Victorian literature at Oxford, taught at Princeton, currently a member of the faculty at Columbia. Back then, of course, that's a long time ago. She may well be dead by now, I don't know. At least I've never seen anything from her in subsequent years, although I've been aware of this book for a long time. Anyway, this was published, the copyright is 1977, Avon Books, division of the Hearst Corporation, so put out by a major publisher. The Feminization of American Culture, which I cannot under-recommend for understanding the degradation of Protestantism in the U.S. from something very serious and intellectual to something frivolous and trivial, to use the word Henry Ford always used. The Jews trivialized the public mind, but it was prepared in the 1800s what the Jews would do in the 1900s by this cheapening and shallowing of everything. Trivializing of the public mind. Teachers Without Texts. So we're going to do, this is a very brief subdivision, and then there's one longer, so we're probably going to do two of them in this segment. We're starting on page 197, so we basically made our way through half the book. In truth, I don't know, man. I'm going to go as long and hard as I can, I swear. Glenn Frey died from basically the same junk that I have, right? I read with raised hair. He had very serious ulcerative colitis. He had surgery for it. He also had rheumatoid arthritis and pneumonia, and I've had very similar symptoms. Kind of coated lungs for 2-3 years. I kept coughing stuff up. I'm mostly over that, but I still, you can somewhat tell. I try to disguise it, but coughing it, it's keep having musky covers come into my voice. It's very irritating. It takes me, sometimes I have to talk for an hour before I get that all talked out. And I have had bouts of arthritis, and if you've ever had that, you know exactly what that bout is, the perfect word for it. But he apparently had surgery, the Eagles band member, and died from it. He died at 67, and as I read this to you, I'm 49, so hopefully I got a good 18 years left before my Adams go free agent and see if they can find a better constellation to become part of. Oh, well, we never know how much time we have, so it behooves us to use our time wisely, or at least enjoyably. Anyway, one thing I enjoy doing is reading in serious texts and thinking about them, reflecting on them. Now we're going to discuss this together. Now, she says, in truth, to publish serious theological work was to go against the increasingly anti-intellectual. See, there I go. Exactly what I'm talking about. Was to go against the anti-intellectual temper of the times. Few liberal Protestant clergymen had the training, inclination, or courage for such an attempt. And again, we're talking about the middle decades. It's decade by decade, the progressive degradation of the clergy profession as they go from being serious students of theology, to the extent theology is serious. What this means is you can accept, if you don't accept the premises of theology, that God exists and that the Bible is his book, then the whole thing seems silly and bootless, as it does to me. But if you do accept the premises, then there's a fair degree of intellection, a very high degree, in fact, of the working out of these points. So it may seem kind of an academic exercise, but it has broader cultural effects, which can be degrading or uplifting, one supposes. And she says it was degrading as they turned more and more to feelings and away from institutional seriousness and rigor. So publishing serious theological work was against the temper of the times, the zeitgeist. Few liberal Protestant clergymen had the training, inclination, or courage for such an attempt. With notable exceptions, they were apologists, not preachers. Temperance men, indeed. They diluted their doctrines to suit the taste of their listeners. And again, this goes along with the disestablishment of the church, where there's no formal state support. Then you have to cater to customers, at least to some degree. And if they don't like you, then maybe you find it harder to find employment. We've already seen them say that you need to be a gay young fellow, good-looking and cheerful. They were far preferred to the old gray-headed scholar types, even though the gray-headed scholar types might have had more what the people actually needed. But the people prefer what they want. Not difficult to understand, is it? They diluted their doctrines to suit the taste of their listeners. Over the course of the 19th century, the Protestant minister became the only professional other than the housewife who ceased overtly to command, much less monopolize, any special body of knowledge. His self-esteem developed or depended more and more on the hope, even the genuine attempt, to be better, and less on the claim to have learned certain skills which would allow him to do better. Be and do in italics. One is reminded of the housewife of today's television ads. She is presumably obsessed with putting the right detergent into the laundry, yet even if her choice is effective, she expects no more from her family than a kiss or a compliment, whose offhandedness stresses that it is no act of recognition. Her bold sons and husbands and less bold daughters, putting on their sparkling clothes, are uninterested in the why of it. They simply feel better. Her family is on the move, on the go, while mom is stationary. She functions like scenery affecting the mind of the traveler. Her interaction with her family must appear accidental, if fortuitous. And some of the feminism of Douglas is coming out here. The housewife, submerged in dubious expertise, is expressed only in the tip-off glance she exchanges with her equally weary and indispensable feminine audience. She is in the know, but barred from the conceptualization of what she knows. Mothers and ministers, with their undetected skills, keep their bustling families and congregations more decent than their bustling should permit. Despite their secret supremacy, even despite the real service they perform and the satisfaction they may take in it, they have abandoned any right openly to participate in the process of change or fully to understand it as a phenomenon. Whining for respect. Whatever the causal relationship between ideology and events, it is clear that ideas play a crucial part in the comprehension and enactment of a personal and social change. Dogma, the commitment to a certain set of ideas, creates precision not because it fosters the illusion of certainty on all points, but because it can help its subscribers to pick the right chance and nerve them to take it. We induce people to alter partly by urging them to think, and to think from a different perspective than the one they normally adopt. Let's read that again. We get people to change by getting them to look at what they're doing from a different perspective and seeing how it might be better than the one they would just unthinkingly almost adopt out of habit, perhaps. No one who wishes to affect change can cease to be an educator. No educator can do his work by starting exactly where his hearers are, nor with their assumptions. If he does so, and the majority of liberal Protestant ministers, like the majority of American middle-class housewives and mothers, have increasingly done so in the last century, his educative role has become part of what historian Daniel Boorstin terms a pseudo-event, quotes, an event designed and arranged so that people will notice it and believe it to be happening, though it will in fact not take place, a trick of public relations which proves only the existence of a performer and an audience, proves, in other words, that only that the embryo market situation does indeed exist. Such an educator provides, no matter how unwillingly, merely window dressing for the forces which control his society. An ideology can represent a significant mode of resistance to economic determinism. It is a way of giving the vote, so to speak, so that part of oneself, no matter how small, which has withstood for whatever reasons the pressures to conform. We have already seen why an occasionally hostile lack of interest in theological thought was inevitable among educated and literary Protestant women, and what they had to gain from the demise of theology. Unlike the ministers, the women had never been involved in the formation or perpetuation of Protestant dogma. This does not mean, however, that they had a better substitute for it than did the ministers. Their efforts to make other women experts in, quote, domestic science, unquote, were robbed of vitality by the intrusion of technology into the kitchen. Mother at home was forced to play hostess to male inventions. Their hopes to make women into professional mothers were diminished by the appearance of male child psychologists and educational experts who guided rather than followed feminine practice. Yet educated 19th century American women, like ministers, wished to see themselves as missionaries and teachers. The sincerity of the dismay which they expressed as women and Christians when they contemplated a world irreligious and basically antagonistic to feminine concerns can hardly be questioned. Who does not want in some way to change a society which denigrates her? Their choice to capitalize on the subversive, even subliminal aspects of their faith, rather than to emphasize its strength as a sustaining ideology for protest, was logical and inescapable, but this is another way of saying that they were in certain ways doomed to failure. If the women under discussion disavowed openly strident feminist methods, the goals they worked for were feminist ones. Better education, more opportunities, more respect for their sex. Notice how she calls it sex, whereas if she were writing today, she would almost surely call it gender. But sex refers to biological, anatomical differences. Gender is properly used with grammar only. And then they've tried to extend it to mean the kind of the culture built on the biological difference of sex, but they've used gender to replace it because they want to always promote the lie, the big lie, that all these racial or sexual differences are social rather than fixed. No, all that we have that relates to women is built upon the biological, psychological difference. It's not something that is taught. It's something that obviously is a response to what is always there because it always reappears. Whenever we have girl children, they act a certain way, you see. The leftist view doesn't even make any kind of rational sense. The progress of women's rights in our culture, unlike the other types of progress, has always been strangely reversible, in part because historical circumstances have always made it impossible for a significant numbers of women to adopt an ideology appropriate to their position. As 19th century women neglected Protestant dogma to point out the undeniable yet often overlooked nurturing values contained in their religious heritage, so 20th century women thus far have stressed emotional supportiveness, quote, in quotes, rather than the usually Marxist doctrines which elsewhere buttress communal thinking. Nurture and supportiveness are essential values in any feminist humanist vision, but they need some structure to inform them if they are to be achieved rather than espoused. The Victorian lady, with her dislike of theorizing, set an example which proved compelling even to her more overtly politicized descendants. As a preacher of the gospel, the liberal minister was presumably committed to the hope of changing men, yet he renounced the right to educate his congregation into his nominally chosen system of conceptualization. Unlike his predecessors, he seldom delivered a series of sermons on a selected knotty theological problem such as the doctrine of election. His sermons tended instead to be, in the broadest sense, occasional. Henry Ware preached, to take some examples at random from his works, on the duty of improvement, a New Year's sermon, and the parallel between Jewish and Christian Passovers. Little wonder that the Protestant Church during this period magnified and proliferated religious occasions in ways that would have appalled its Puritan originators, who austerely disregarded even Christmas and Easter. So the Puritans weren't even into celebrating Christmas and Easter. They were that serious and that anti-frivolous. And this all changed in the 1800s. The Victorian Church, in multiplying holidays, the intrusion of stasis into the realm of change, was simply honoring and extending the only valid license of its preachers. Skills gained their authenticity from the recognition of unavoidable facts presumably entailed in their acquisition. A lawyer, a doctor, even a psychiatrist whose function is closest to the minister's, asserts that his ability to help his client is largely independent of the worth of his own personality. He knows what passes for law or medicine or the psyche. The liberal minister who abandoned theology lost his right to start from the facts of the Bible as his predecessors understood them. That God made man, man sinned against him, and man had and has the right to assign any punishment he judges fit for the offense. Men in this older view live in a world not of their making, in which they are, in momentous and ultimate senses, not at home. The minister is the only specialist in the knowledge they need to locate themselves, like your truth, your creature, your spiritual being, created by God. And you're in this world, but not of it. And here's how you get to heaven. Here's how you need to conduct yourself on earth. I am the specialist. I am the professional expert in these matters. You should listen to me. See, that's the older way. And the new way is, I'm your buddy. I'm your friend. I'll help you live a better life. And we don't really know about heaven and God and all those things. Who's to say? But I'm your life coach and your buddy. You know, you see the difference there? Abandoning theology, the minister lost his expertise in the realm of what the psalmist called God's thoughts. He was inevitably forced to seek the lowest common denominator in the minds of his listeners, some loosely defined preoccupation with spiritual, social, and personal matters. The sermons of liberal Protestants inevitably became a bit like today's horoscopes. You will want love this month, but you may not find it. Trust your old friends. Designed to fit any set of circumstances and lacking the corrective bite provided by a sense of historicity, that this is grounded in actual historical fact and thus needs to be taken seriously. Not just as an idea, but an actual real-world story, you know, Jesus, etc. The intellectual failure of which I write is all too apparent to need belaboring. What is perhaps more important is the failure of the majority of ministers and women involved to achieve genuine success as opposed to popularity in the forms with which they attempted to replace theology. Any contemporary chronicler of American historians acknowledges the numerical supremacy of clergymen, and sometimes of women, among the 19th century authors of biographies and local histories, and then goes on to dismiss their productions in a few pages. Any modern student of popular American fiction and belles-lettres, that is, fine arts, in the same period is forced to mention a host of names, usually those of women, occasionally those of ministers, which are unfamiliar to the general reader. The clerical and feminine authors whose works are so largely forgotten today were caught in a double dilemma. A minister might initially reject a theological form, the treatise, as unpopular and uncongenial, even though he felt guilty at his reluctance to undertake it. Unhappy and constricted within the secular or secularizing form he had chosen, like poetry and such, to alleviate his original anxiety, however, he might well end by reminding his readers that it was only his didactic religious purpose that prompted him to embark at all into poetry or biography. Didactic meaning of a teacher teaching a lesson. So the natural form would be to simply do the hardcore theology in a treatise, but he's got to be popular and reach people, so he puts it into poetry or bio, but she's saying these turned out to be intellectually insubstantial, thus all these people who dominated popularity at the time are forgotten now because their works were light. A female writer, putting suitably feminine piety into unsuitably popular and public modes, went through a similar cycle of self-assertion and self-doubt, which left her, perhaps by design, too preoccupied to devote her energy to the problems inherent in her chosen vehicle, and all too willing to use her original religious intent largely as self-justification. Ministers and women, unable to own up fully to the demands of either their subject or their form, subverted both. The literature thus produced, whatever its actual merit, is important for the mass culture it helped to bring into being because of its fundamental and complicated obsession with mediocrity. Authors feeling a confusion of purpose, such as I've just described, were by definition and by choice amateurs, not professionals. They could hardly wish to call attention to themselves, to boast of achievement in any usual sense. They could hardly fail to produce a partially genuine critique of the prominent and a defense of the unskilled, the forgotten, and the common, the mass-produced items of modern life. They were of necessity interested in those multitudinous situations, events, and persons which they could deceptively portray as lying outside the process of conspicuous historical change, but which served in actuality to absorb and mute it. And that ends that subtitle, which was very brief. Sort of the rise of mediocrity. Next subtitle is The Romantic Historians, History as Protestant Religion. History as Protestant Religion. Though a nation of churchgoers, Americans were not concerned with theology. What, if anything, did hold their intellectual attention? The answer in varying forms until the eve of the Civil War seemed to be history. By 1860, there were 111 active historical societies in the United States. 90 of these had published some proceedings. And this in a country where there were only 55 towns with a population larger than 15,000. Between 1800 and 1860, 90 of the 348 bestsellers in America, over one quarter, were either histories or books on historical topics. The seven most influential periodicals of the day developed fully 30% of their contents to historical subjects. By 1840, history was widely taught at the elementary school level. As early as 1790, Noah Webster, in his popular textbook, The Little Reader's Assistant, allotted half his space to historical material. The formal study of the past made its way slowly but surely into high school and college curricula. Moreover, American fascination with history, at least initially, stimulated and gained strength from the growing American absorption in fiction. To put it quite simply, history itself provided the most suitable subject for literature in post-revolutionary America. As English critics were all too fond of pointing out, there seemed to be a dearth of new literary work in this new country. Who reads an American book? The British wit Sidney Smith inquired in 1821. His query was snide, but not jesting. Was there a lack of literary material or motivation? Innumerable nationalist literary apologies, flowed from the pens of anxious defenders of American culture or proto-culture in the early and mid-19th century to quell such anxieties. Their authors argued that American energy was necessarily in large measure devoted to the development of a continent, not to the pursuit of the arts. Such arguments blossomed logically in the proclamation that America itself was the greatest poem, and its exploitation hence an act of the imagination, as of the body. Well, we're putting our national genius into business, and that's our art form, rather than empty literary work, as in the more established countries. America's material was clearly in its extraordinary and, hopefully, providential history. A city on a hill, that's taken from the Old Testament notion of ourselves, had one obvious subject, itself, and those civilizations which paralleled threw into relief or prepared for its progress. They try to find parallels in the Old Testament to what they think they are doing in the new continent. It is a commonplace to remark how, quote, literary the great American historians of the early and mid-19th century were. The popular works of William Prescott on the Spanish conquest of the New World or the studies by Francis Parkman of the wilderness struggle between French and English were frankly formed on dramatic models and organized around carefully contrived flights of rhetorical eloquence. So early historians Prescott and Parkman, and sometimes find Parkman's works in at book sales were basically, they were historical, but they were definitely dramatic and literary in their form, she's saying. History was sometimes touted as a kind of antidote to fiction, exciting but not enervating. The demand on the historian, however, to write well, to be accessible, to provide entertainment, to focus on character, to orchestrate events, in short, to remember Sir Walter Scott in the Waverley series, never flagged. A critic writing for the Atlantic Monthly in 1859 urged frankly that a work of history should be pleasurable for its readers as the airiest novel. In his young manhood, Prescott tried his hand at genteel light literature. Parkman, like John L. Motley, the historian of the Netherlands, produced a novel. Even George Bancroft, the Jacksonian celebrator of Manifest Destiny, began by publishing a volume of poor Byronic verse. All four men saw themselves throughout their careers as practitioners of belles lettres, of fine letters, literary art. The real progenitor and rival of the new history was less literature than theology. The quickened American interest in history was, of course, part of a major intellectual shift which involved all of Western Europe, particularly Germany. To put it simply, people began to believe that the most profound and meaningful way of viewing life was as a series of events unfolding uniquely in historical time. Man's growth and his measurements of it, in other words, took on enormous new significance. The attitude of the seminal German thinkers, with whom several of the best of the American historians studied, was not necessarily or apparently anti-Christian or anti-clerical. Indeed, their philosophy of history represented a complex transformation of Protestant dogma. And again, remember how America had few PhDs at this time, and we just started developing our programs. A lot of the people who would develop them went over to Germany and got PhDs there and learned how the thing operated, and then came back and sort of established similar schools within schools in the U.S. So, one could almost say that the German romantic historian philosophers were performing a complex intellectual operation by which they transplanted the heart of Protestant theology into the body of secular society. And God became the state for Hegel. Hegel was the precursor to Marx. G.F.W. Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, perhaps the most important philosopher of the 19th century, like many of his competitors and followers, was as willing to find in the dialectical, historical patterns he elucidated what another great German historian called, quote, "the loftiness and logic of the development of the ways of God." As ever, John Winthrop, the 17th century governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, had been to see the design of God in the suffering of a band of colonists on the Massachusetts coast. It seems obvious that the great dialectic of Calvinism, God versus man reconciled in Christ, was in part responsible for the concept of historical progression as thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, worked out by German philosophers like Hegel. It seems obvious the great dialectic of Calvinism, God versus man reconciled in Christ, God's Son who became a man. The great dialectic of Calvinism was in part responsible for Hegel's idea of synthesis, that is a thesis, an antithesis, and then a synthesis of both of them moving forward to create a new thesis that will have an antithesis, and then a resolution and a new synthesis. Moreover, the combination of a sense of tragedy with millennial hope. Now, millennialism, I may get this a little wrong. You might want to look them up. But millennial, these are all words that I learned first in National Review from William F. Buckley. Millennialism, that's the belief that Jesus is going to come back. I'm pretty sure. Same with like chiliasm. There are numerous words that are essentially beliefs that there's going to be an end time. And there's going to be when the Savior comes back and the elect are hied off to heaven and the rest of us stand there sucking our thumbs or going to hell or whatever we do. But that belief in a eventual millennium. the return of the Savior, the coming of the millennium. That's what millennialism is. Or chiliasm is another word that's uncommon. I've only seen it used in National Review or books by her authors back from the old days when they had erudite people writing for them. Anyway, moreover, the combination of a sense of tragedy with millennial hope, see, hope for the return of the Savior, a combination frequently attended on dialectical thought, was common to Hegelians and to Calvinists. Hegel stressed continually the waste of history. He eloquently referred to history itself as a slaughter bench, trying all these things that don't work. The great mass of men, in Hegel's theory, do not further the great historical design, and even those who do advance it count less for their motives and aspirations than for the effects they produce, effects often contrary to their intentions. Winthrop, that is the leader of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 1600s, like his Calvinist brethren, Winthrop, understood historical waste too. Winthrop's deity also elected his instruments with a fair degree of arbitrariness to serve his purposes. So what you may think you're doing may not be what you're actually doing when looked at from the eagle's eye view of overall history. Yet Hegel believed, as John Winthrop or Jonathan Edwards did not, that the dialectic operates only in time. As a result, in apprehending whatever reality means, it is more essential in the Hegelian view to perceive the differences than the similarities between historical epochs. Hegelian philosophy, committed to this relativistic assumption, concerned itself less with the discovery and meaning of the immutable laws of God's universe, and more with the definition of the ways by which men perceive or project such laws and how these perceptions alter over time. The German thinkers most directly responsible for the inception of the intellectual presuppositions with which we still live, Herder, Hegel, Schlegel, Fichte, Schiller, and Goethe, all partly available in English by 1850, characteristically began their work with an attempt to formulate the distinctions between the classical, the Christian medieval, and the modern periods. Hegel described philosophy as its age comprehended in thought. That's a direct quote. Philosophy is its age comprehended in thought. Philosophy was now chained to history, not to theology. St. Augustine, the greatest of the early church fathers, had believed, as others did after him, that the Christian should direct his thoughts toward the eternal city of God. He wrote the city of God and city of man to contrast them, and ignore the flux of his earthly home. St. Augustine's 19th century German successors, equally fascinated with constructing a historical theological worldview, disagreed. They saw the fundamental philosophical task as the comprehension of the significance of change, a phenomenon which, we do well to remember, interested St. Augustine relatively little. By a paradox essential to Calvinism, history for the Calvinist had represented not only God's immortal plan, but mortal life experience. The end, God's glory, was foreordained, but the means, whether furthered in a given individual's salvation or damnation, meant as much as that end. Although it was not, according to the older Protestant view, in man's power to determine whether or not he personally was saved, his spiritual state was nonetheless justifiably and rightly his most momentous concern. Hegel's was a view of history which, in a way unthinkable to Winthrop and those who thought like him, discounted the state of a man's soul. Hegel started and ended with what actually happened, the, quote, accomplished end, and its result as operative upon the actual world, as Winthrop could not. Even as he tried to save himself from entrapment in matter, in what he called, quote, the madness of what has happened, unquote, by amplifying a teleological view of events, teleology refers to an end purpose of things, study of the purpose of the ends of things, a, quote, final aim for which these monstrous sacrifices have been made, Hegel subordinated means to ends. Winthrop could never have used the word sacrifices. Every life has, to his mind, served. Hegel's perception of the relentlessness of change in human life produced in him a fascination with force potentially separable from any awareness of God's design. His conception of history was inevitably both intellectual and elitist. Finally, the only consolation for the sheer magnitude and waste of historical motion lay in philosophic perception of the patterns it formed. The young American scholars who went to Germany expressly to approach thinkers like Hegel or Goethe made sure to let their friends back home know that they were dutifully sorting out the wheat from the chaff. George Tickner, the future professor of Romance languages at Harvard, and German is not a Romance language, acknowledged that the Germans, quote, are a people who at this moment have more mental activity than any other existing, that among them are the handful of intellectuals who define the issues of the day, but he was also convinced that they frequently misdirect and even, quote, pervert, unquote, their enormous talents. Goethe might be a genius, but George Bancroft, future author of the most popular history of the United States ever written, found him, quote, dirty and bestial. Such New Englanders hoped to gain intellectually while keeping their religious commitment intact. This was, of course, not possible, nor probably desirable. Of the seven most important figures in the development of post-revolution American history, George Tickner, Edward Everett, Jared Sparks, George Bancroft, William Prescott, John Lothrop Motley, and Francis Parkman, none were untouched by the new German historiography and the transformation of theology integral to it. And that's probably the most important sentence we're going to read in this particular segment that we're doing. She says, let's read it again. So of the seven main figures, they were all touched by this new German historiography, this new focus on history. Everett, Sparks, Barcroft, or Bancroft, and Parkman were all either the sons of ministers or ministers themselves, and these four made a conscious choice against the ministry and for the historical profession. Bancroft, the son of a Unitarian minister, came back from his sojourn in Europe determined, after prolonged struggle, on the career of a clergyman, yet he seemed unconsciously set on defeating his own decision. He wore outlandishly foppish velvet clothing. He dropped affected phrases like, "Our dear Pelican Christ," from the Cambridge pulpits to the dismay of his listeners. He soon left the ministry. After a stint as a teacher, he became a full-time politician and historian. Edward Everett was not officially an historian, but he made his name through orations on the American past, on Adams, Jefferson, Washington, the fathers and their deeds. He too gave up a clerical career, and one which began far more brilliantly than Bancroft's. Hardworking, eloquent, capable of everything, as his student Emerson astutely recognized, except of finding a mission in life. Everett took over Joseph... Capable of everything except finding a mission in life, Everett took over Joseph Buckminster's Unitarian pulpit at the tender age of 20. A few years later, without breaking openly with the ministry, he made, like Bancroft, a step sideways toward the academy. He joined the faculty of Harvard College as a professor of Greek. By the age of 26, he could write his sister about the, quote, natural disdain, unquote, he felt for many of the concerns of the ministry, and expressed scorn for the much-celebrated sermons of the prodigious and sainted Buckminster. Quote, their puerility of style and affectation of literary correctness were calculated to do the least good to those who most need it. 4 years later, in 1824, Everett was elected to Congress, and, like Bancroft, he abandoned the ministry altogether for politics, diplomacy, and history. Jared Sparks, the editor of the multi-volume American Biography, made no such formal shift. He gradually redirected his energies from the duties of a Unitarian minister, which he had transformed largely into editorial work in any case, toward those of a talented eulogizer of the American past. It was Parkman, the youngest and perhaps the greatest of the group, who most defiantly chose history as a protest against what he considered the effeminacy of the liberal church. His father, a clergyman, also named Francis Parkman, was a disciple of Channing. Witty, gentle, ineffectual, melancholy in temperament, he insisted on observing fading clerical proprieties and aided groups like, quote, the Society for the Relief of Aged and Indigent Clergymen. He apparently aroused little respect in his son. In later years, the younger Parkman liked to recount a childhood scene whose hostile implications he clearly cherished. His father was talking with a sentimental feminine parishioner while the little boy sat unobtrusively sketching nearby. When asked politely to show the grown-ups his picture, he revealed a tableau in which three devils were carrying away a minister. The sketch was clearly Parkman's translation of the feminine clerical dialogue on which he was eavesdropping. Throughout his life, he referred to ministers as vermin. Hilarious. Not one of the new American historians, however, altogether disdained the clerical theological profession. All of them, whether consciously or otherwise, expropriated and rescued a number of its most vital traditions for their own use. Even those historians who had never considered the ministry as a profession embraced the career of historian with what it seemed at times seemed appropriated zeal. Prescott, the son of a lawyer, and Motley, the descendant on the paternal side of the merchants, underwent what can only be called conversion experiences. Prescott, wealthy and charming, was known among his acquaintances as an idler, almost up to the moment when Ferdinand and Isabella was published in 1838. George Ticknor, in his biography of Prescott, takes care to show his readers Prescott's stern self-control, to share with them the examining journals, the reiterated resolves which nerved Prescott in his struggles to produce. Motley, as a young man, represented a more desperate case than Prescott. He was considered less gay than dissolute. Reputedly beautiful after the Byronic fashion, he possessed the elegant insouciance of a Bulwer Lytton dandy. Bulwer Lytton was a novelist. Motley had been well-educated by Bancroft himself at his Roundhill Academy, but at Harvard the reading he pursued was chiefly fiction. When a tutor reproached him for such superficial tastes, he answered with all the nonchalance of a determined trifler, quote, "I am reading historically and have come to the novels of the 19th century. Taken in a lump, they are very hard reading." Further study in Germany prepared for, but did not precipitate, his destiny. By 1839, at 25, he knew, however, that the study of history offered him the discipline he apparently despised, but secretly craved. The hero of his first novel, Morton's Hope, is made tellingly to confess, quote, "The groundwork of my character was plasticity and fickleness. I was mortified by my ignorance and disgusted with my former course of reading, largely poetry. I now set myself violently to the study of history." Motley's Rise of the Dutch Republic did not appear until 1856, but by the mid-1840s he had discovered the therapeutic value of the research involved in the new history. For all its literary qualities, early 19th century historiography prided itself chiefly on its disavowal of impressionism, its obsession with the facts, with the object, as the German historian Leopold von Ranke put it in an immortal phrase, "wie es eigentlich gewesen war," as it actually was. Or, she puts it, as in itself it truly is. Wie es eigentlich, as it actually eigentlich means, gewesen war, as it was. Prescott, reviewing Washington Irving's conquest of Granada in 1829, writes happily of the factual impulse of recent history. Poetry is confined to her own sphere. So you're sort of seeing that this, as science and industry grow, you're sort of seeing the same factuality attempted to be reproduced in the softer sciences, and a movement away from theology to actual historical fact as a more solid ground for knowledge. Even if they're still looking to define God's ways, at least they're interested in the actual facts of what happened. And this comes from the new criticism in Germany, where they look at the Bible, try to treat it as history and verify its claims. This attitude is communicated to these seven top American post-revolution historians, four of whom have a directly ministerial background through their fathers, you see, and themselves in some cases, as we're hearing. So very interesting. This is explaining how the U.S. developed and how its elite developed and how they came to think the way they did. Now, moving on, let's see. Prescott, Motley, Bancroft, and Parkman did extensive work in European and American archives. Like their Calvinist predecessors, They solaced themselves with the belief that their labor was putting them in touch with, and was even itself equivalent to, truth. What I'm finding is truth. What I'm doing even is truth. I am the human embodiment and representation of truth as I seek for the truth. Be occupied always, Prescott admonished himself. Sparks, whose career was an exemplum of effort, warned others that idleness and dissipation will never purchase their devotees a seat in the temple of fame. Prescott and Motley both spent a decade preparing their first major studies. History offered these pioneering historians what theology had offered their fathers, the resource of exhaustiveness. They tended to conceive of their work in terms of a massive life plan. Bancroft and Sparks meant in their different ways to treat all of American revolutionary history, Prescott to detail Spanish-American relations in their entirety, Motley to document the Germanic-Dutch impulse to liberty, Parkman to cover the struggle of England and France in the New World from start to finish. They undertook their monumental tasks in the same spirit in which Edwards and Hopkins dedicated their futures to the consolidation of their theological systems. So, whereas... okay, so there's an elite in America. There's a specific quantum of intellectual firepower, let's say, or ammunition, or whatever you want to call it. And it could be expended upon preparing a consolidated theological system, or it could be put into decades of researching particular aspects of history. But in either case, it's exhaustive, it's complete. And this is how white men naturally are. They want to figure out the whole thing. They want to do something that no one's done before. They seek legitimate, as he's saying, fame and even fortune in doing something good and useful that no one else has managed before. So we understand this now. Research for the historian, as formerly for the theologian, could involve not just labor, but martyrdom. Parkman's chosen subject, the American forest, and the fervency with which he pursued his experience of it, remind one of the arduous missionary forays of earlier Calvinists like John Eliot or David Brainerd. Parkman wrestled, as did Prescott, against lifelong illness. Parkman's enemy, as he called his disease, was an incapacitating disorder centered in the head. Prescott's was incipient blindness. But both men battled on in the spirit. Hopkins or Emmons, those are the old hard line, descended from John Edwards, sinners in the hands of an angry God, would have recognized and appreciated. So they were true to their hardcore intellectual, long hours, seriousness. All these good things, right? Both men battled on in a spirit Hopkins or Emmons would have recognized and appreciated. They overcame their physical difficulties. In spite of the incredible physical difficulties they faced, they carried on with their serious intellectual pursuits. And we can admire them for that. Everett, Tickner, Bancroft, Prescott, and Motley, these are all good WASP names, during their student days and long after, habitually worked 10 to 14 hours daily, a regimen reminiscent of that which men like Hopkins and Edwards had imposed on themselves. Timothy Dwight and William Ellery Channing confessedly injured their health by their zealous overcommitment to the study of God's Word. Parkman admitted that he had done violence to his constitution in preparing for his career. Prescott knew he could regain vision in at least one eye if he would stop the necessary reading for his work, but he never seriously considered such an abandonment of his vocation. The transfer of energy formerly assigned to theological tasks into the service of history is as apparent in the work as in the career patterns of the most prominent 19th century historians. With Hegel, they appropriated from Protestant theology a notion of dialectical relationship and development, which they used to understand the phenomenon of change. In every sense coming after Hegel, they became more interested in the fact of change than in the laws which tried to explain its purpose. At first glance, the underlying preoccupation of the Romantic historians appears to be not only in a secular but a political one, the rise and spread of liberty. It is important to remember here that the beginning of modern historical writing in the U.S. coincided with the winning of independence and a consequent debate and controversy over the form of government appropriate for this exemplary new nation. The burst of historical activity was thus part of the scramble among towns, states, sections, and parties for a controlling voice in American affairs. Jefferson was sure that Judge Marshall's Federalist Life of George Washington was designed to influence the election of 1810. A Southern reviewer objected to Bancroft's stress on New England. He was fully cognizant that, if Northerners wrote the nation's history, they would, quote, become our masters. American history was thus politicized and political from its inception. It naturally tended to stress the importance of politics and of the special American brand of politics. George Bancroft, while always maintaining devoutly with Hegel that God directs human progress, argued consistently that the religious liberty the Pilgrims had sought was, intentionally or otherwise, the precursor for the political freedom of which their 19th century descendants boasted. Despite his lifelong love of Jonathan Edwards, he became vividly interested in the ministers among his subjects only when their aspirations most transparently took on a directly political cast. Motley, writing several decades after Bancroft began to publish this, or his, history, found the meaning of the struggle of Protestant Holland against Catholic Spain in the Dutch quest for political independence. Even Prescott, justifying the conquistadors' conquest of Mexico, pointed up the despotic nature of Aztec rule, ignoring for the moment the equally dictatorial regime to be imposed by the Spaniards. Yet, the persistent theme of Romantic historians was not finally politics, deep as their involvement was in political affairs. They would each have defined the term freedom differently to begin with. Bancroft was a Jacksonian Democrat who considered himself, quote, radical to the heart's core, while Parkman, Prescott, and Motley were in varying ways patrician in their allegiance. Parkman was clearly not as politically oriented as the others, yet he was definitely of their school. It is as if in Parkman's work the political focus, with its rather spurious optimism, can be dropped as adventitious. That is, outside and not organically related. Whatever their very real flaws of attitude and judgment, Romantic historians saw too deeply into the meaning of their country to concentrate on its democratic mission. Although they might not have been willing to say so, their common interest was less in liberty than in the course of empire, quote, the phenomena of discovery, expansion, struggle, conquest, and exploitation of which politics is but one reflection. Whether it was Cortez defeating the Aztec leader Montezuma, or La Salle planting the French flag in the American wilderness, the drama which fascinated them was that of imperialism. Their work is finally, in the broadest sense, not political, but military history. They were profoundly, if inconclusively, involved in the study of violence. Jared Sparks, apparently the least biased member of the group, the one most determined to be fair, in compiling his popular 25-volume Library of American Biography, which he intended as a kind of biological or biographical history of America itself, notably stressed adventurers over saints. The vast preponderance of his lives, 25 volumes of biographical biographies of Americans, as a history as biography, 25 volumes, wow. The vast preponderance of his lives are devoted to explorers, soldiers, and politicians, those who manifested, above all, energy. Despite the fact that Sparks selected his biographers from every walk of intellectual life, including the ministry, the portraits which emerge are strikingly similar. Whether the subject is William Phipps or Alexander Wilson, whether the writer is Minister William Peabody or the scholar Alexander Everett, the focus is on the problem of masculine ambition. Captain John Smith, whose, quote, life and adventures, unquote, are given by the literary critic George Hilliard, or Hillard, in the second volume of the series, could serve as a prototype of those whose lives succeed his. He is one, quote, among the adventurous spirits whom a restless love of enterprise called from the bosom of repose in England to new scenes and untried perils in our western wilds, unquote. He was fortunate enough to, quote, live in striving and eventful times and to find in America, quote, an object attractive enough to keep his imagination perpetually kindled and vast enough to task all his powers. Such words suggest that their author does not live in such times, does not have such an object. Men like Hillard or Sparks are warming their hands very self-consciously at fires they have not kindled. This is clearly the value of history to them. It permits their vicarious participation in the massive energies at work in their society. It allows them imaginatively to invoke and to control the ungovernable spirit animating capitalist culture, change itself. So these super intellectual men are participating in the building of their country by their enterprise is to describe these vast spirits and energies that are out there dominating, exploring, and creating empires. Sparks used his role as historian to reenact the drama of discovery and enterprise which so fascinated him. Like his major peers, a pioneer in the archival research, remember that's a big thing with David Irving, is doing actual first-hand research in the archive, not reading a dozen books and simply rewording what all those people say. That's not real history, you would say. Real history is going in the archive and digging out original documents. And this is where that attitude maybe got its start in the 1800s. Like his major peers, a pioneer in archival research, he traveled thousands of miles and examined innumerable hitherto unseen manuscripts in the course of his work. He felt himself, quote, an explorer in the untrodden fields of American history. The letters he wrote to friends in 1827 from Mount Vernon, where he was going through the Washington papers, read a little like those of a general engaged in military operations, sending dispatches to his civilian contacts. Most of Stark's stable of writers for the American Biography series engaged in no such strenuous forays, yet they are consistently uninterested in those who overtly most resemble their own scholarly selves. They dismiss sedentary pursuits with consistent scorn. They lust for the event, which they implicitly define as the moment of impact. The relatively short shrift given to clergymen in the American Biography is explained when Converse Francis, the biographer of John Eliot, apostle to the Indians, passes rapidly over Eliot's lengthy, settled ministry in Roxbury. Quote, there is not much to be told, for the life of a clergyman as such, though full of toil, is not full of events. Francis concentrates rather on Eliot's missionary work with the Indians, and he is primarily interested in the fact that it was largely a failure. Christian piety cannot integrate the natives into modernizing society. To convert the Indians, as the Puritans originally intended to do, in Francis's narrative, as later in Parkman's, only hastens their demise. Faith all by itself is a sign of passivity and of approaching obsolescence. Sparks, Prescott, Motley, Bancroft, Parkman, and their followers were writing what Nietzsche would call monument history. The commemoration and celebration of significant masculine achievement, all the more impressive to these authors for its evanescence and futility. The vastness of the topics and the periods they covered, as well as the organic theory of history as a process of conflicting and resolving forces which they had appropriated from the German school, made imperative an epic panorama and synthetic sweep from which, by definition, only the mightiest figures, those in Hegelian terms possessed of the spirit of the age, quotes, could detach themselves and emerge with clarity. The works of the Romantic historians are marked by a sense of unending motion, which both parallels and finally contains the aspiring will of the chief protagonists. Motley clearly enjoyed writing the historical introduction to his Dutch Republic, in which he compressed a millennium into its most significant details. The necessity of condensation makes him an aggressor, an historical hunter stalking the ages for his prey. You know, are you worthy of selection in my compression of the events of this millennium? That attitude. His excitement gradually mounts. At the close of the introduction, he switches into the present tense. As he prepares to usher in his story proper, the narrative, released, can dilate momentarily. This beginning is not deceptive. The overall rhythm of Motley's Dutch Republic, like that of Prescott's Fall of Mexico, is a counterpoint of movement and collection, force and resistance. The spectacle of the ever-turbulent masses, the ever-moving ages, is periodically broken by the set portrait of the hero or villain, whether Philip II of Spain or Cortez. The arrest involved in these moments of portraiture is deliberate and self-conscious. The historian honors his hero, no matter how he may abhor his principles, by exempting him briefly from the flow of his narrative. We stop to take a look at this particular person, this particular man, because he's bigger than his times or than the history itself. So it's worth stopping. Otherwise, the rest is just easily dismissed. But this person changed things somehow. And we honor him by giving his portrait in words. The arrest involved in these moments of portraiture is deliberate and self-conscious. The historian honors his hero, no matter how he may abhor his principles, by exempting him briefly from the flow of his narrative, just as Cortez or Philip fought to impress his nature upon his times. The sea metaphor Motley uses again and again are appropriate in telling beyond their obvious relevance in a history of Holland. In Motley's narratives, as in those of his fellow historians, the heroes inevitably drown in the flood of the account, but they are allowed vivid and full flashbacks before they do drown. The logic of the narrative suggests that their energy is less only than that of the process it attempts to alter. The style the best of the 19th century American historians employed, a highly rhetorical, oratorical, grand style of one speaking, illustrates the same law of motion which governs the narrative form, : exhibitionism struggling heroically to arrest the attention of an utterly mobile universe. Bancroft was known, even criticized, for the profusion and extravagance of his descriptive powers. In revising his early volumes, he felt bound to engage in what he called slaughtering adjectives. Yet it was the later writer, Francis Parkman, who produced the most highly crafted, quote, purple prose. He spoke of Hennepin's discovery of Niagara thus, quote, on his left sank the cliffs, the furious river raging below, till at length in primeval solitudes, unprofaned as yet by the pettiness of man, the imperial cataract burst upon his sight. Close quote. This is a style which places a high value on conspicuousness and waste. He doesn't just say there, and there he came upon the Niagara. He describes it using all kinds of fine and high adjectives. What is prominently displayed is in the same moment thrown away. The effect of restlessness in Parkman, Motley, or Prescott is heightened by a profusion of metaphors whose occasional confusion seems a result of the quickening pace. Motley describes Philip the Fair, the father of Charles V, as, quote, the bridge over which the House of Habsburg passes to almost universal monarchy, but, in himself, nothing. The reader's half-realized impression that one cannot be both a bridge and a nothing is lost in the tide. Philip is both precisely because even before the close of the sentence, the perspective, invincibly progressing, has necessarily shifted. Motley has not revealed any literary incompetence here, but he has demonstrated his lack of interest in what could be called a stable metaphor situation. Characters, places, scenes are subjected to a kind of transformational grammar of events. There is a constant and complex lip service paid in these works to the Hegelian dialectic. Motley can refer almost clinically in passing to the rules of historical change. Quote, even as in all human history, the vivifying becomes afterwards the dissolving principle. Unquote. The invincible impression held by the reader that these narratives are not altogether dialectical comes less from a questioning of their author's sincerity in using these such phrases than from an unavoidable awareness of attention directed just barely elsewhere. Philosophic concern with a dialectical process is lost in fascination with its sheer momentum. The dialectic becomes self-consciously absorbed in its own pace. Parkman, Motley, and Prescott are masters of the art of flashback and anticipation, and the obvious but rich ironies to be garnered by this method. Edward Everett, in an 1853 oration on the discovery of America, speaking of the 1492 proclamation by the Spanish throne that all lands found in the future by Columbus will belong to Spain, notes ominously, quote, thus was America conquered, before it was discovered. Everett's perception here of the fundamental law of imperialism, as of capitalism, that appetite can be so strong as to presume digestion before the fact of consumption, is a recurring and controlling one in the historical work of Everett's friends. Dialectical fate is present. The oppressor will die. The oppressed will rise, only to oppress in turn. But the motion which accompanies and accomplishes this process tells far more than the outcome. Look, for example, at the magnificent closing paragraphs of Parkman's Conspiracy of Pontiac, 1851. Parkman has just described the assassination of the Indian leader after the defeat of his attempt to expel the English from the lands of his tribe. Here's a block quote now from Conspiracy of Pontiac, 1851. Thus basely perished this champion of a ruined race. But could his shade have revisited the scene of the murder, his savage spirit would have exulted in the vengeance which overwhelmed the Indian abettors of the crime. Whole tribes were rooted out to expiate it. Over the grave of Pontiac, more blood was poured out in atonement than flowed from the veins of the slaughtered heroes on the corpse of Patroclus. Neither mound nor tablet marked the burial place of Pontiac. For a mausoleum, a city has risen above the forest hero, and the race whom he hated with such burning rancor trample with unceasing footsteps over his forgotten grave. And time to be replaced by Africans, because they're talking about Detroit, I'm pretty sure. The point here is, of course, the irony. One should note how thoroughly in Parkman the dialectical process had been detached from its benign Hegelian end. Even more important, however, is the aimlessness, the omnivorousness of the irony. Pontiac's death, ironically, leads to more Indian revolts. The Indians, however, by a further irony, destroy principally themselves rather than their white conquerors. By a last and most wrenching irony, the Indians' beloved forest have been replaced by cities which Parkman, no sympathizer with the Indian cause, clearly dislikes almost as much as Pontiac himself. I mean, no city more cityier than Detroit, right? Giant auto industry. Tied to the inexorability of history in the Hegelian sense, committed to the fait accompli which yields a vivid tableau but little explanation or moral resolution, Parkman has been forced to resort to ambiguity, as in itself artistically and philosophically conclusive. In a multitude of unsatisfactory and limited possibilities simultaneously presented, Parkman has discovered a suitable ending, and that's very modern, or even postmodern. In the Conspiracy of Pontiac, there has been, finally, no winner, but the ever-alert principle of irony, the spirit of change itself. And that will conclude this section. We've been reading and discussing from The Feminization of American Culture, talking about the transformation of history as a discipline from something more concerned with myths and something very closely tied to religion to something more concerned with facts, and a shift, a rechanneling of intellectual powers from the creation of consolidated systems of theology into the discovery of scientific facts and the spending of decades in actually visiting archives and digging up the truth about historical periods and then presenting them in fine books. And very interesting stuff. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with me today, and we'll be back and do some more from this book again real soon.